This meeting of the House Judiciary Committee will now come to order. The time is now 1:03 p.m. on Friday, March 6, 2026. We are meeting in the Grunberg Room, Capitol Room 120. The following members are present: Representative Eichheit, Representative Costello, and myself, Representative Gray, Chair. Let the record reflect that we do not have a quorum to conduct business, but we do have enough people to conduct introductory hearings. I would like to recognize the staff supporting this meeting: Sophia Tenney from House Records, Chloe Miller from Juno LIO, and Dylan Hitchcock Lopez, my committee aide. We have two items of business on today's agenda. House Bill 316, Adjust Damages Limit, Personal Injury, Wrongful Death, Representative Gray and Dylan Hitchcock Lopez, and its first hearing in our committee. And House Bill 324, Virtual Currency Kiosks, sponsored by Representative Moore, but it will be her staff, Inti Mayo Harbison, who will be presenting today for its first hearing in our committee. As our first item of business, we will take up House Bill 316, Adjust Damages Limit, Personal Injury, Wrongful Death, for its first hearing. As the bill's sponsor, I would like to say a few words about this legislation. In this committee, we often discuss how to better support victims of crime and ensure that they receive meaningful compensation for the harm they have suffered. Yet we often overlook the civil justice system's role in delivering that compensation. Over the last 30 years, the non-economic damages cap has not been adjusted for inflation. This erosion has significantly diminished victims' ability to recover damages for pain, suffering, and emotional harm. The purpose of this bill is to remedy that gap and provide a more meaningful opportunity for victims to be made whole. At this time, I would like to invite my staff, Dylan Hitchcock Lopez, to the witness table to walk us through the bill and answer any questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Gray, members of the committee. For the record, Dylan Hitchcock Lopez, staff to Representative Gray. So non-economic damages are a category of damages that compensate people who have been harmed for non-pecuniary harm. That's things that you can't easily reduce to a receipt. So these are things like pain and suffering or physical impairment, disfigurement, the loss of enjoyment of life, the loss of consortium, the loss of your relationships with the people that you love. These things are difficult to pin down, but they are important harms that people suffer. And so at a civil trial, the judge or the jury will be tasked with excuse me, I had to switch to committee aide duty. Now back to staff duty. For the record, Dylan Hitchcock Lopez, staff to Representative Gray. So at a trial, the fact finder will be tasked with coming up with a number for these damages. And they will have to, you know, the plaintiff will have to present evidence, and that, and they will weigh that evidence and they will decide what they think is fair. However, under Alaska law, as it currently stands, there is a cap set by statute that even if a judge or jury thinks that more money should be required to compensate that person, they are not legally authorized to award more damages. So that cap was set by this body in 1997. And the legislature at that time did a careful weighing of, on the one hand, trying to ensure that there wouldn't be these runaway verdicts and these massive damages award that were totally out of control. But also on the other hand, to make sure that people had a meaningful opportunity to be compensated for this loss. And so after doing this balancing, the legislature established these caps. And I want to read from the statement of intent that came when those caps were enacted. The stated purpose of the act was to encourage, quote, encourage the efficiency of the civil justice system by discouraging frivolous litigation and by decreasing the amount, cost, and complexity of litigation without diminishing the protection of innocent Alaskans' right to reasonable but not excessive compensation for tortious injuries caused by others. And since it's kind of legalese, I want to read the last sentence again. Without diminishing the protection of innocent Alaskans' rights to reasonable but not excessive compensation. Because what has happened by operation of inflation is that that right has been meaningfully diminished. The non-economic damages caps, which are in a wrongful death or personal injury lawsuit, the general cap is $400,000 or the injured person's life expectancy in years multiplied by 8,000. Whichever is greater. And then for injuries involving severe disfigurement or severe permanent physical dis- physical impairment, the cap is raised to $1 million or the life expectancy multiplied by $25,000, whichever is greater. But now that was 30 years ago. So effectively now, those when you adjust for inflation, these caps are actually worth in real dollars only about half of what they were when this law was enacted. And so gradually we have resulted in an imbalance in what compensation people can be can recover. So the purpose of this act, it's not to do anything new. It's not to move the law in any stride away from what that legislature thought. It's to restore the balance. And so by correcting for inflation, the hope is that we can just maintain the balance that the legislature thought was appropriate in 1997 and ensure that it is the correct balance going forward, regardless of what inflation does. And I did want to say that, Alaska is an outlier state in capping these kinds of damages. Every state phrases the breakdown a little bit differently, so it's hard to be entirely precise. But by my research, it's only 9 or 10 states have these kind of non-economic damages caps. And then, so in personal injury and wrongful death cases, 41 states in D.C. don't have a cap for this, based on my research. And then of those states that do have a cap, at least two that I've found, Idaho and Maryland, inflation adjusts the cap. So really, we are already in a minority position by having a cap at all, and this would just ensure that the cap keeps up with the cost of living. So I'm happy to field any questions from the committee or answer anything else I can.
Thank you, Mr. Hitchcock Lopez. Are there any questions from committee members? Representative Eichel.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair. Are there other areas in current statute that likewise cap awards, if we would, similar to this?
Through the chair to Representative Eichscheid, the other place that we obviously see this is in the medical malpractice context. So there are medical malpractice caps as well. However, the statutory scheme around medical malpractice is significantly more complicated and has other implications for other parts of the law. And so this bill is more narrowly focused on general tort and personal injury outside of the med-mal context.
Follow up, what has been the aggregate inflation since 1997 to today? And it can be, the easiest way is a dollar in 1997 would have what purchasing power today? If you can give a idea of that, please.
Yeah, and so the act is, or the bill is specifically tied to, it would be specifically tied to the consumer price index adjusted for, urban Alaska. The reason for picking that is because that inflation adjustment mechanism appears in other places in Alaska statute. And in fact, our own state of Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development maintains a CPI adjustment calculator for that data, so it's readily available and easy to do. So running those numbers, it's basically worth a little less than half today, or a little more than half today. So I actually ran it for these damages caps. So the $400,000 in 1997 today would be $750,901. Does that answer your question, Representative, through the chair?
Actually, I guess, can you also do the reverse calculation? So $400,000 in 1997 is worth what in today's dollars? It would be, I could do the math, but I'm asking you to make it easy for me.
Approximately $220,000 to $230,000. That's a little bit off the top of my head. I'm not the best at math, but I think that's pretty close to what I looked at.
That's my calculation too. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Costello? Nothing. Okay, seeing no more questions from the committee, we will now take up public testimony. Public testimony on House Bill 316 is now open. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? Please come forward, put yourself on the record, and begin your testimony.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen of the committee. My name is Jason Scala. I'm a private civil attorney in Anchorage, Alaska, but I do work all over the state. My concentration is primarily in rural communities of the Northwest Arctic Slope. A couple of things I think to lay some groundwork is that this issue has been reviewed by the Supreme Court. The seminal case is Evans ex rel Cooch v. State, 56 P3D 1046, and that's Alaska 2002. And that was the first to pick it up and say, is there a judicial solution to the disparity or the failure to account for this? And I believe it was inadvertent, and I'll discuss the statutory construction in a minute. But and I've got a list of cases that I will provide to the committee. But as recently as 2022, and that's Mail v. Cook Inlet in Housing Authority, where there were constitutional challenges made to this, the court has been clear since Evans that this is a legislative fix. It is not a judicial fix. And the words that they use there is that there is judicial deference to legislative policy choices in tort laws. And then consistent with that theme, the statutory fixes are a legislative responsibility rather than a judicial one. And this has been repeated in cases consistently for 20 years, as recently as 2022. And I think even a cursory review of those shows that even with constitutional challenges, the deference remains in the legislature. Which brings me now to what I consider to be an inadvertent disparity. It was not baked into the law because if you look, and this works in concert with Alaska Civil Rule 82, which the gentleman just discussed, which is that we follow the English rule. So in most cases, if you're not the prevailing party, they award 30% of the prevailing party's full actual attorney's fees. And there is some judicial review of that, but normally that's what you're going to find. And that, by its construction, by the way it was written, is indexed because with the increase in legal services every year, it simply remains a percentage of those services, which is why what the gentleman discussed and what this bill is proposing, I would analogize it to federal criminal, where we decided something, a felony criminal act or not. A lot of those are set by the in property crimes, at least by the value of the crime, the property involved in the crime. And those have to be indexed. Otherwise, people would be getting felonies for things which at the time it was enacted was a substantial amount, but because of inflation is not. And so I think this is, again, it was inadvertent, but that this was part of a package of legislation that was enacted, including Civil Rule 82, and they were intended to work in concert, and they did until we all know inflation struck. I approach this as an access to justice because I have to determine in any given case, and you know, every lawyer has to do this at the end of the day. You have to make payroll. You have to pay the overhead. So you have to determine, is the juice worth the squeeze? And you can't do that from the standpoint of the attorney looking at the case. You have to look at the risk versus the potential benefit. I want it to be clear we're talking about compensatory damages here, not an award, but where the judicial system is to try and determine what is the value of the loss that was suffered. If I could quote Clint Eastwood in the case of wrongful death, it's a heck of a thing killing a man. You take away everything he had and everything he's going to have. Arguably, that's the largest loss, but the loss is felt normally by the family. And the idea of these compensatory awards are so that the family has the possibility now that dad is not there of getting a car, paying for college, getting a down payment on a house. So, I can show you, I'm not submitting to committee, but in anticipation of this, we want to know what did everyday things cost in 1997 versus now. A Big Mac in 97 was $2.75. It's approximately $9 now. Median price of a home in Alaska, and this is Zillow data, but it was $135,000 back then. It's $412,000 in urban communities now. Gallon of gas was $1.20. Gallon of gas is $3.85 now. But I want to talk about the access to justice aspect because a lot of my experiences with rural communities, a gallon of gas is $7 to $9 in most coastal Northwest Arctic communities. And so the impact unintended to all of us is disparate, I believe, with the most vulnerable communities, especially the elderly and the working poor. Because the purchasing power, even at a full award, as we just discussed, is about a half. I would argue for many of these things, it's much less than half. I can just hit you with the last of them. A gallon of milk was $4. In rural communities, it's now $15. Even in Anchorage, it's $6.50. A new car was $23,500. Average in an urban community, $49,500. In a rural community, because of shipping, it's just shy of $55,000. Now, the reason that I suggest that the focus here should be on determining who is harmed and what is the benefit comes back to the fact that this legislation isn't isolated. It was enacted as part of a package which did work until inflation happened. And what happens now in the metric of do I take a case or don't I take a case is that you have to advise your client in their best interest, is the juice worth the squeeze? And what's happening inadvertently now is that every year the penalty for going to court and not prevailing in your case increases while the value of the award decreases. So every year it gets harder. And it would be nice if we had people that were judgment proof, but for a lot of people, they have minimal savings and the primary asset is a home. I understand without getting into, they can protect it in bankruptcy and all these other things, but you're looking at potential financial ruin if you take the risk. And so what is the I think, unintended consequence of that is that you have people every year devaluing the worth of an Alaskan. And the only thing that hasn't gone up in nearly 30 years now is the price of an Alaskan life, whereas everything else continues to increase. I do not believe in any way, shape, or form that was the intent of the original enactment. It was so that we had things in parity, and because part of the law does and part of the law does not, the two are far out of balance now. And so I think updating the law itself isn't a divisive or contentious issue, because that was the original intent, was to strike a balance between meritorious suits that should proceed, especially in this. I do a lot of the civil side of victims of violent crime. Drunk driving would be one of the most common. And in those cases, especially in rural communities, you have to assess if we proceed beyond simply filing a case, but to trial, are the potential downsides worth the risk to you of the recovery? And almost universally, that's what causes people to balk. It's not the value or their care for their loved one. It's that if you don't prevail, you didn't just lose your father or your grandfather or your child, you stand to lose everything. And with that, I will provide all this and more to the committee if you're interested, especially the judiciary advising this body that it is up to you to fix. And this does seem to be the solution that was anticipated by our judiciary. So if anyone has questions, I'd field them. Otherwise, I would close my time.
Mr. Scala, thank you so much for your testimony today.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the room who would like to testify? Seeing no one else in the room, we'll move online. We'll go first to Mike Kramer in Talkeetna. Please take yourself off mute, put yourself on the record, and begin your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Mike Kramer. I'm calling in from Talkeetna today. As stated by the sponsor and their aide and by Mr. Scala, you know, the issue is, what was the intent of the 1997 legislature, and should this legislature do something to effectuate the intent? As was stated, you know, the cost of living in Alaska has increased almost 100% since 1997 when AS 917-010 was passed. To effectuate the intent of the 1997 legislature, we need to add a CPI adjustment to that statute. It was apparently overlooked. Many other statutes have CPI adjustments. Representative Zach Fields put together a list of 22 statutes that annually adjust for CPI, and that was in support of HB 96, you know, another related matter, or an unrelated matter, I'm sorry. Some examples of statutes that have baked in CPIs are the state minimum wage, the Alaska Exemptions Act, property values and criminal offenses, teachers' retirement system, state labor agreements. Another good example is legislative pay. In 1997, your salary was $50,400. Now it's $80,000. Almost everything, when we put a dollar value on it at a certain date, we recognize we need to adjust that for inflation. And this adjustment is long overdue. It's caused numerous problems and harms to Alaska citizens who are harmed by the fault of others. And this is a common sense adjustment to effectuate the intent of the 1997 legislature. for Alaskans talked about the wrongful conduct of others. In 2026, $400,000 is no longer a reasonable limit that needs to be adjusted to honor the intent of the legislature and help Alaskans to not be denied access to justice. It still discourages, and the intent of this tort reform statute in 1997 was stated in the bill to discourage frivolous litigation, decrease the amount, cost, and complexity of litigation, and to adjust it for CPI does not in any way diminish the intent of the law. All those goals will still be achieved by simply adjusting for the cost of living. Most of what I came prepared to say has already been said by others, so I won't repeat them. I'd like to give you an example, though, of how this law has affected at least one Alaska family. Senator Mike Kelly served in the legislature in 1997. He was one of the sponsors of this tort reform package that included 917-010. Senator Kelly was killed in a plane crash in 2016. His widow sued the airplane parts manufacturer that was responsible for his death. It went to a jury in 2022, and a jury awarded Mike's widow $3.5 million in compensatory damages. The judge, because the law required it, reduced that award to $400,000. That is a real-world example of how it has affected an Alaska family and of someone who was an original sponsor of the bill and the $400,000 cap. Please pass this out of committee. I know we're running short on time in this legislative session, but this bill needs to be heard in other committees and hopefully can come up before a full vote. It's time to make the CPI adjustment baked into this law as it is with at least 22 other state statutes that sets a dollar value on things. Thank you.
Mr. Kramer, thank you so much for your testimony today. I do not normally correct people from their personal testimony, but the pay for legislators in 1997 was $24,000. It went to $50,400 in 2009. We'll go to our next testimony from Whitney Wilson in Anchorage.
Thank you, everyone. Good afternoon. My name is Whitney Wilson. I am also a practicing civil attorney, and I'm based in Anchorage, Alaska, though I've worked throughout the state. I will try to be brief. I'm going to echo some of the comments that I've already heard here today, but I want to emphasize again that the purpose of civil damages is to make litigants, people who are harmed by the wrongful conduct of others, people who are innocent in their day-to-day lives, their lives are changed irreparably. Sometimes they even have suffered death and their families are having to pick up arms, pick themselves up again after that death. The purpose here is to try our best to make them as whole as possible with that loss. It's not retributive. It's not punishment. Is to make them whole. We have a cap on that now, but we are clearly dwindling away on their ability to be made whole. Again, death that can never be done, but we do what we can through the civil process. The criminal justice system doesn't provide for that kind of opportunity for litigants. It's only the civil justice system that does that for them. But they are facing significant headwind because of the rising costs of litigation, because of the rising costs that attorneys' offices are facing, and the diminished capacity of that civil compensation with the caps to make themselves whole and access justice. I'm not going to take up any more of your time. Again, I echo the comments of others, but this is a very common sense adjustment that does well to value human life, Alaskan human life, recognize it, and essentially place trust in the everyday jurors to appropriately value that human life and have those judgments with limits be preserved. So I certainly hope that it's passed here and support it moving forward as well. Thank you.
Ms. Wilson, thank you so much for your testimony. We'll now move to Jeff Barber in Anchorage. If you'll please take yourself off mute, place yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, my name is Jeff Barber. I am another attorney practicing in the civil area here in Anchorage. And I am in full support of this bill and have experienced since 2001 working in this area the unfairness that have been discussed by some of the other individuals here, particularly in the wrongful death area. I would point out, and I don't know if this was already stated earlier, but Colorado's cap on wrongful death is capped at $2.125 million, I believe is the accurate figure. And the idea of capping them and replacing the there was no reason for an index when the jurors were deciding the amounts of these damages, which has been the traditional way this has been done. And the replacing the jurors' verdicts with the legislative caps is it's an aberration in some instances. And the particular hardship, there have been a number of cases that have been evaluating the constitutionality of this. And frankly, at some point, the cap is likely to be determined unconstitutional anyways, because in particular, as other states have decided, without having any kind of index for inflation, the values are becoming, you know, over the years and over the decades, completely disproportionate with what people would expect and certainly what jurors in particular would award. So replacing the jury's decisions with an amount determined by the legislature is a violation of the constitutional right to have a court, jury of peers decide a case. And the only thing that keeps this law as presently even in effect is the fact that the challenge hasn't come along to address the issue in the particular instance. The damages that a person has for the non-economic losses include damages oftentimes in inability to earn a living for oneself, even to the extent that there's a separate damage for loss of income. The ability to work in the field where one chooses to work is a damage that is normally compensable. And there's all of the different categories are subsumed by this single cap: pain and suffering, loss of enjoyment of life, inconvenience, physical impairment. There's a variety of categories, and they're all subject to this cap. And so, anyway, it's been long overdue, and I just want to express my support for this, and it would be good to bring Alaska into the future and into the at least the present of other states that have already addressed this issue. It's fixing a problem that exists in our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barber. Is there anyone else online or in the room who would like to testify on this bill? Seeing no one else, we will now close testimony on House Bill 316. I would now like to set an amendment deadline on House Bill 316 for Wednesday, March 11th, 2026 at 11:59 p.m. Please work with my committee to ensure that amendments are submitted on time. We will now set House Bill 316 aside and bring it back up at a later date. Our second item of business is House Bill 324, Virtual Currency Kiosks, for its first hearing in our committee. This time, I would like to invite Representative Moore's staff, Inti Mayo Harbison, to the witness table to introduce the bill and answer any questions. He will be followed by Ms. Clark Flint Barr, who is going to give a background presentation. I guess that's your invited testimony. I'll get to that later.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Gray, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Inti Mayo Harbison, staff to Representative Moore. House Bill 324 really looks to bring up to date Alaska's fraud prevention laws, especially related to cryptocurrencies. When Alaska first put our fraud prevention laws into place, cryptocurrency was not something that was top of mind or even existed. And so a lot of times what we find is that it's not included within those fraud laws. There's very limited ways which police can try to recoup that money that an individual has been defrauded out of. And so this bill is just looking to try to put some more safeguards in place for individual Alaskans who we've seen an increased instances of these defraud cases through cryptocurrency, and that has started to become especially prevalent through cryptocurrency kiosks. You should think of those, in essence, like an ATM that you can go to, you put your money into, and you get cryptocurrency or can send cryptocurrency. Very easy, very straightforward. Unfortunately, what that is leading to is a lot of individuals, there is now an easy way to defraud them out of their money with no way to really trace where that money goes. we've seen this happen across the nation. Some states are reporting that these kiosk frauds specifically are accounting for nearly 90% of cryptocurrency fraud that's occurring in their states every year. And so in an effort to try to get out ahead of these issues here in the state of Alaska, we want to put some safeguards in place to protect individuals from that fraud. Like I mentioned, it's very hard to recoup this money after it happens. So this bill is looking to put safeguards in place that would prevent this fraud before it happens, hopefully, or if this fraud does happen, the impact to the individual will be considerably less than it currently is. Happy to take questions from the committee or go through the sectional analysis if it is the will of the chair.
Thank you. I have a question. So have you actually gone to a virtual currency kiosk and tried to purchase cryptocurrency yourself?
Through the chair, I personally have not, but I know a number of individuals who have. I actually happen to know some individuals who have been defrauded in this method, and so it is something that I know is occurring at least anecdotally, though I don't have the exact numbers for the state of Alaska.
My follow-up would be is when you do that, let's say you've never been to a virtual currency kiosk before and you want to go buy some cryptocurrency with cash, what information does the ATM ask from you in terms of, you know, does it ask for your name? Does it ask for, do you need to set up an account? How does it work?
Yeah, through the chair. And I'm not entirely familiar. This may be a better question for our invited testimony.
Okay. I'll hold my question.
But from what I understand, these kiosks do collect a little bit of information from you, you know, bank information, some personal information, in order to make the transaction. But there's no real reporting mechanism on the other side of that. So, for example, if an individual is defrauded out of their money, the kiosk may be able to tell law enforcement your information, but they would not be able to tell law enforcement where that transaction went to.
Again, I have another question that is probably best for the invited testimony. I'm just curious, you know, a normal ATM just has a numbers pad. Like, I don't know how you input your name. And I'm also, of course, curious, again, I'll hold. You could just type anyone's name in, right? I mean, how do they know? There's not a person there.
So through the chair, I believe it, again, it is similar to like an ATM transaction where you would put a card in potentially, you would put your information in. But yes, I believe there are a number of issues with the current method that this bill is looking to address.
Thank you. Any questions from committee before? I think we will hear the sectional if that's okay.
Yeah. So the sectional analysis for House Bill 324, Section 1 is related to the regulation of virtual currency kiosks. Section 0655120 relates to the licensing and registration of those kiosks and mandates that they hold that operators hold a valid money transmission license. And it would also require the department to approve every physical kiosk within the state. Section 0655125 relates to reporting. It's putting in place quarterly reports that operators must disclose locations of virtual currency kiosks, addresses used, number of transactions declined due to illicit activity, etc. And those annual reports must also report gross revenue, total transaction volume, etc. Section 0655130 relates to disclosures and requires a clear, conspicuous warning about fraud at kiosks. For example, warning this technology can be used to defraud, et cetera. And it mandates detailed receipts for individuals who complete transactions with these kiosks, including transaction hashes, exchange rates, and law enforcement contact information. 0655135-140 relates to fraud prevention and blockchain analytics and requires operators to maintain a written anti-fraud and anti-money laundering policies. And it also mandates the use of blockchain analytics and tracing software to block transactions to fraudulent wallets or inaccessible overseas exchanges. 0655145 relates to posted warnings. So this would make it so that kiosk operators must post conspicuous written warnings regarding potentially fraudulent activity. 0655150 relates to user identification and requires identity verification via a government-issued ID for all transactions, and so that relates to your question earlier, Chair Gray. And it establishes strict liability for operators who allow transactions under false names or identities. 0655155 relates to training and requires that kiosk operators annually provide training to new staff and may not prohibit staff from educating kiosk users on fraud or scams. 0655160 relates to refunds and grants the victims of fraud a statutory right to a full refund, including fees, if they notify the operator within 90 days and provide a police report. Operators must issue refunds within 72 hours of receiving that documentation. 0655165 relates to communications and stipulates that kiosk operators must have written notices in English and Spanish and provide interpretation services as necessary. 0655170-172 limits on transaction fees places a $1,000 per day per user limit on these kiosks and would place a 30-day $10,000 per user limit. 0655175 relates to customer service and requires kiosk operators to provide live customer service between the hours of 8 a.m. and 10 p.m. Alaska Standard Time, including a toll-free number. 0655180 relates to law enforcement access to investigate this information. An operator is required to provide a dedicated line for government agencies, and the dedicated line must be regularly monitored. In addition, operators must provide law enforcement or a regulatory agency with trace finding and blockchain analytics. 0655185 relates to penalties. Violations are classified as unfair or deceptive under the Alaska Consumer Protection Act, and operators are subject to civil penalties, seizure of kiosks, and forfeiture of all fees collected during this period for noncompliance. 0655190 relates to municipal regulations and allows Alaska's municipalities to adopt stricter ordinances than the state. 0655195 relates to definitions, and you see those provided there. Section 2, AS 0655840, exempts virtual currency kiosk transactions from general money transmission refund rules to ensure the specific, more consumer-friendly refund protections within this bill are what take precedence. And Section 3 is conforming language to include those who are operating a virtual currency kiosk.
Thank you so much, Mr. Harbison. Any questions from the committee? Representative Costello, and then Representative Aisha.
Thank you. How many companies in the U.S. Produce or manufacture these types of kiosks?
Through the chair, Representative Costello, I'm not sure an exact number. That might be a question better directed to Ms. Clark Flintbar.
Representative Eichheit.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, a question on the limits on transactions and fees. You know, very clearly it's $1,000 daily limit, a 30-day limit of $10,000, and then a fee cap of 3% of the transaction value. What was the rubric or rationale to come up with those three numbers?
Through the chair, Representative Eichheit. I believe the $10,000 number is sort of standard banking procedure within anti-fraud laws and regulations. So, for example, if you took $10,000 cash to a bank and put it into a bank, there's some additional steps that you may have to go through. As far as the other two numbers, what we are finding across the United States is that oftentimes these are a single transaction, and so an individual will be defrauded in a single moment. It's not that they're returning to that kiosk repeatedly to send more money to that individual who is defrauding them. And so early intervention we find to be far more effective than trying to recoup that money from a source that it's very hard to figure out who that money has been sent to just because of the nature of cryptocurrency in general. So setting that limit at a lower number, we believe, will help to prevent that fraud, or if that fraud does occur, it will be less damaging to individuals.
Follow up. So I understand what you just said, but I still don't know why $1,000 for a daily limit was chosen, because you know, if I had $1,000 in my pocket, that would be a big number for what I typically carry around. So can you provide any more nuance why $1,000 and not $2,000 or $3,000?
Through the chair, I believe that's just a starting number. You know, at some ATMs have a $300 withdrawal limit, for example. That, and I believe that the bill sponsor would be open to having those conversations. But I believe that $1,000 number is really just a starting point based on what other states have done.
Okay, thank you.
I'll just say I come from a different perspective. I think than Representative Eichheit. I did go up to the cryptocurrency kiosk in the Midtown Mall. The very first question it asked me when I pressed the button was, do you plan to deposit more than $3,000 today? I think that's the most crazy first question from a random ATM I've ever been asked in my entire life. Like, who's got $3,000 cash or more than $3,000 cash in their wallet that they want to deposit right now? So if this bill passed with this current limit, then that kiosk needs to change its first question. But I think if it's okay with you, we'll go to our invited testimony.
Yes.
Thank you. So Ms. Clark Flint Barr, if you would please take yourself off mute, put yourself on the record, and I believe we can pull, or are you going to manage your own slideshow?
Yes, I will. Thank you. Hello, everyone. Thank you for having me here tonight. My name is Clark Flint Barr, and I'm here on behalf of AARP Alaska. Let me see if I can get my slides to show correctly. Can you confirm that you can see my slides?
Yes, we can see them. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. Again, thank you, Chair and members of the committee, for having me here today and for the opportunity to testify. My name is Clark Flint Barr, and I'm a Government Affairs Director for Financial Security at AARP. In my role, I advocate for policies to protect consumers, particularly older Americans, through fraud, financial exploitation, and scams, which we are increasingly seeing wipe out families' life savings in a matter of moments. Before joining AARP, two and a half years ago, I worked for a company that built cryptocurrency investigation software. So I spent a lot of time looking at fraud that was happening in the cryptocurrency space. And before working in the cryptocurrency software industry, I worked for the FBI, where I was an intelligence analyst. And at the FBI, I focused on transnational organized crime groups and the crimes that they were committing using the dark net, much of which involved cryptocurrency as well. We're very grateful for the committee's attention to an issue that has become a major driver of fraud losses, as has already been noted today, cryptocurrency kiosks. Now, these machines are increasingly being used by criminals as a fast, hard-to-recover payment rail, and they've made it easier for scammers to steal tens of thousands of dollars from victims very quickly before family members or law enforcement or anyone else can intervene. So tonight I'm going to cover a couple of points, and I'm making notes of the questions that you're asking. We'll try to address those as I'm going, but please let me know if you have other questions or if there's anything else you'd like me to address. I'm going to talk about why AARP is working on this issue, some of the overall fraud statistics both nationally and in Alaska, what a cryptocurrency kiosk is and how it works, the scams that we're seeing using cryptocurrency kiosks, and the legislative principles that AARP thinks are important protections. Okay, so why is AARP working on this? Well, AARP has a fraud watch network that we operate, which does consumer education and awareness on a number of different fraud issues. And we also run a helpline for victims of fraud and for their families. And we get about 100,000 calls a year on that helpline. And one of the trends that we saw on our helpline was that we were hearing from victims over and over and over again who had been coerced into putting cash into one of these machines and having it stolen from them. And I want to be clear, AARP is not anti-cryptocurrency. We simply want to make sure that there are adequate protections in place to prevent fraud victims from being sent to these machines by criminals and then having their hard-earned money stolen from them in one fell swoop. Now, cryptocurrency kiosks, which as has been noted, often look like bank ATMs, lack many of the consumer protections that we expect from traditional financial institutions. And what makes cryptocurrency kiosk fraud uniquely devastating is a combination of a few things. The speed with which cryptocurrency moves, money can move from the victim to the criminal almost immediately. Irreversibility. Once cryptocurrency transactions have been initiated, they are irreversible, so you cannot get your money back. And there's frequently little or no recourse for victims. And then, like I said, a lack of meaningful protections at the state level in many jurisdictions, including Alaska. And I want to underscore sort of the level of illicit activity that is happening using these machines. And a lot of this comes from data from lawsuits that have been filed by the attorneys general in different states, including Iowa and Alabama. And in Iowa, the attorney general found that the top two kiosk operators in their state, CoinFlip and Bitcoin Depot, which are also the top two kiosk operators in Alaska, they found in an analysis of their transactions that 94% of one of the operators' transactions were the result of fraud. I said again, like only 6% of the transactions were legitimate customers who were going to use the machine. 94% of the people who were transacting using those machines were fraud victims. So that was for the first operator. And for the other operator they sued, the number was even scarier. 98% of the transactions conducted through that operator in the state were the result of fraud and scams. So I think these numbers are pretty terrifying, and they really show the scale of the fraud that is happening here, and how these kiosks have really become a perfect tool for scammers.
Ms. Flint Barr, do you want us to hold questions until the end of your presentation, or would you like us to ask questions about a slide as it happens?
Oh, please feel free to ask questions.
Okay. Correct. I would like to ask a question about Mabel's story. If you could just flesh that out a little bit, because, you know, in my mind, I'm like, she called the wrong Netflix number and then sent $250,000. It's hard for me to make that make sense in my mind.
Yeah, so this is a type of fraud that is often called tech support fraud. So in Mabel's case, Mabel is not her real name. It's changed it for privacy. But in Mabel's case, she was searching online, trying to get Netflix's support number. And what we increasingly see is that criminals have figured out how to search engine optimize criminals' phone number, like the scammers' phone numbers, and they have pages that look very convincing. They can sort of buy these packages of like pre-developed websites, so they can look very official. And so she called what she thought was Netflix, and when she called them, it turned out to be a scammer. And usually what happens in these instances is that they will tell you there's some terrible problem with your account. They'll make things up like they've found compromising child sexual abuse material on your computer, and now you're going to be referred to law enforcement if you don't pay these fines. And people who are not technologically savvy or have less experience with technology often don't understand that this isn't something that Netflix could, like, even if that were true, Netflix would have no knowledge of that. And I think the other thing that's important to know is that scammers are taking advantage of you being stressed and disoriented. And often when you talk to victims after the fact, they're like, well, of course that doesn't quite make sense. And in retrospect, I don't know why I did that, but in the moment, like, I just wanted to fix this issue, and they were screaming at me, and they were telling me that they were going to send people to my house to lock me up if I didn't pay. And so people panic. They, our Fraud Watch Network will often call it an amygdala hijack, where your reasoning is really taken away from you, and you end up operating irrationally in retrospect. But in the moment, you don't realize that's what's happening. So Mabel is one example of these cases. Another common scam that we're seeing with the cryptocurrency kiosks is kind of an interesting one. There's prison rings in Georgia. It sounds like I'm making this up. I swear this is real, and DOJ has been doing prosecutions in this space, but it kind of sounds incredible. Cell phones are being dropped into prisons, and then prisoners are using those cell phones that have been dropped via drones into the prisons to call people and scam them. And usually they impersonate government. So they'll say, you missed your jury duty, and now you have to pay a fine or you're going to go to jail. Or they'll say, yeah, there's a warrant out for your arrest, and if you don't pay, you're going to be picked up and you're going to go to jail. And they've got all this information about you because everybody's information is online now, and they can make it sound very convincing. And so hundreds of thousands of dollars is being stolen in those types of scams as well. And I'll talk about more of the other types of scams that we're seeing too. Does that answer your question, though?
Yes, thank you so much. And I'd like to state for the record that we were joined by Representative Genevieve Mina online via Teams at 1:03 p.m. Please continue with your presentation, Ms. Flintbar.
Sure. Thank you. One other sort of stat I'm going to give about cryptocurrency or crypto kiosk related fraud is that the average amount that is stolen from an older victim, somebody over the age of 60, in a crypto kiosk related fraud case is about $40,000. And that's according to FBI data. So this is, it's pretty significant losses and represents years worth of grocery spending or housing costs, healthcare expenses, and these sorts of scams have really devastating impacts on victims and then also on the local economy. It's draining resources that would otherwise be spent in our local communities. Is this on my end? This slide looks a little bit fuzzy. Are you able to see it?
It's very clear on the big screen.
Okay. All right, good. I'll make sure that a copy of this is sent over in case you want to, in case you're having trouble seeing. But I wanted to share some of the key data points from the FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center, or IC3, which is the FBI's intake center for fraud reporting. In 2024, the FBI received nearly 11,000 complaints related to cryptocurrency kiosks specifically, and it was so many that they in their annual report, called them out in their annual report. So there was a 99% increase in complaints and a 31% increase in losses from 2023. And I would note, it's important to understand that these FBI numbers are a significant undercount of the amount of fraud that we're seeing. These figures are best understood as a floor, not a ceiling. And the FBI data really, it's only capturing the data that's submitted to the FBI. And many victims, rather than reporting to the FBI, are going to report to the state and local law enforcement instead. And it's also important to note that only 10 to 15% of victims report fraud happening at all because of a sense of shame or embarrassment. For Alaska specifically, the FBI data that we have shows that in 2024, there were 48 complaints involving cryptocurrency kiosks with reported losses of almost $1 million. And this is a huge jump compared to the 2023 numbers when IC3 only had two complaints from Alaskans and a total reported losses of $36,000. So you can see a really concerning pattern and a sharp increase in Alaska complaints using which are being used in these cryptocurrency.
Ms. Flynn Barr, I'll just say that I believe 2025 will be drastically different, because it wasn't until last year that I suddenly saw crypto ATMs all over Anchorage.
I am confident you are right, and that data should be coming out either in April or May. So we'll be sure that we flag that for you when it does. It's definitely a very concerning trend that we're seeing across the country and in Alaska. And the other thing I want to point out about this data is the number of cases that you see in the count of complaints and also the losses, where the victim was over the age of 60. The FBI data makes it very clear that older adults are very much disproportionately impacted by this type of fraud. And if you do the math with those with the losses there, so 85% of the losses in 2024 were suffered by people over the age of 60. So this is really disproportionately impacting that population. Okay, and I think this is the part that's going to get into some of the questions that you were asking earlier as well. So what is a cryptocurrency kiosk and how does it work? And Inti was calling them virtual currency kiosks. That's another name for them. Sometimes they're also called Bitcoin ATMs, virtual asset ATMs, BTMs. There's a number of different names for them, but I decided to pick cryptocurrency kiosk in this presentation and stick with that for simplicity's sake. Now, these are machines that they're often placed in everyday locations, grocery stores, convenience stores, gas stations, and they're designed to somewhat resemble a traditional bank ATM, and that can create sort of a false sense of familiarity and safety. But you can see one of your questions was how would you be able to input all of that information if you just had the number pad? If you look at the white machine on the bottom, you can see it's a digital touch screen. So it has more, it's easier to input more information than you would be able to do with a traditional bank ATM, unless it was a sort of very fancy bank ATM. And here's how a typical cash to crypto transaction works. You've got a person who, usually a fraud victim, given the data that we've seen from some of these lawsuits in other states, who approaches the kiosk and they choose the transaction type. So they want to buy Bitcoin, for example. The kiosk will then ask the user to provide a destination for the cryptocurrency. And through this process, they might collect other information like your phone number or your email address. And what we hear from victims is that if they're asked for a phone number or a email address, the scammer is usually on the phone coaching them, and the scammer provides the victim with the scammer's phone number or the scammer's email address. So they're not putting in their own information typically, they're putting in somebody else's. So they'll enter in their phone number or their email address, which is really the scammers. And then they will also tell the cryptocurrency kiosk where they want the cryptocurrency to go. So usually that involves scanning a QR code or entering in a digital wallet address so that the crypto kiosk company knows where to send the money that you're putting into the machine. Then you insert cash into the machine. You're literally feeding $20 bills into the machine. And we hear these horror stories from victims. Like, one woman told us that she spent so long feeding cash into the machine, that the people working in the convenience store came over and brought her a chair because she looked tired. So you can put a lot of cash into these machines. And then what happens is the kiosk converts those funds into cryptocurrency, into Bitcoin typically, but there's many other types of cryptocurrency, and each of the different companies will have different offerings in terms of what cryptocurrencies you can buy. And then it sends it to the digital wallet address that the user has selected when they got to the machine. And once the funds are sent, they move pretty rapidly and criminals will send them through multiple wallets and across different jurisdictions. And that makes the money out of reach and very difficult to recover. Sorry, did you have a question?
No questions. Please continue.
And as I said before, the transactions are irreversible, so you can't claw that money back quickly. Now, at the federal level, cryptocurrency kiosk operators are regulated as money services businesses, or MSBs. And this means that they have to register with the Treasury Department. But unlike what is being proposed here, it's not a licensing regime, it's a registration regime. So there's a lot less oversight than you would have with a typical financial institution like a bank. And so that's one thing to know. I also wanted to note that these are different than, these cryptocurrency kiosks are different from the like larger mainstream cryptocurrency businesses that you're seeing advertised in the like the flashy Super Bowl ads featuring Matt Damon. For one thing, if you were to exchange your cash for cryptocurrency at one of the more mainstream exchanges like Coinbase or Kraken or Gemini, you would pay 1 to 2, 1 to 3% in transaction fees, whereas the cryptocurrency kiosks charge people very large fees, somewhere between 7 and 50% of your transaction. And I think the average is closer to 25 to 30%, which is a pretty sizable transaction fee. So even if you're not a victim and you're like a legitimate user trying to take your cash and convert it into cryptocurrency and send it somewhere, you're taking a pretty big haircut on your investment by transacting using these kiosks. Any questions on any of that?
No questions. Please proceed.
Okay. And I wanted to show you a map of the crypto kiosks in Alaska. You can see there are 64 of them. They're primarily in the Anchorage and Fairbanks area. And just to go back to the stat we talked about earlier, where in 2024 there were 48 complaints and nearly $1 million in losses, that means that there were almost as many complaints as there are machines, and that for each of these 64 machines, victims had $15,000 stolen from them. So I think it's definitely a big problem. Okay. So we've talked a little bit about the scams that we've seen using these, but typically what we see is a scammer reaches the victim by phone or text message, email, social media, the fake tech support searches like Mabel found herself in, and they're posing as somebody you trust. They're posing as law enforcement, they're posing as your bank or a well-known company, Netflix, Microsoft. And the scammer creates this sense of urgency. Unless you act now, you're going to be arrested. Your account is going to be frozen. Your loved one is in trouble. That's another one that we hear about often. The story is usually, and they'll often deep fake the voice of a loved one, and you'll get this panicked call from your child, but it's a scammer using voice software. And they'll say, you know, Mom, I'm calling from jail. I was in a car crash. I hit a pregnant woman with my car. They've locked me up. You need to pay my bail. My lawyer's going to call you. The lawyer, not a real lawyer, calls you and says, you know, the court systems are down. You're going to have to go use this special government machine to send money digitally. You'll find it at the local gas station, and people don't even realize that they're sending money in cryptocurrency. They think it's like a, you know, a fancy new payment method that we implemented during COVID. The scammer will create this real sense of urgency, and they will also keep them on the phone typically and coach them through how this works. And I've got a picture on this slide from one of the attorney general lawsuits, and it's showing all of these older victims being coached on how to send money using the kiosk. All of these people were on the phone. They're all being told exactly what to do. And the scammer will tell the victim to go to their bank, withdraw cash, go to a nearby cryptocurrency kiosk because it's safe, it's secure, only way, it's this new government machine, and they'll walk them through the process of how to send the funds. And then once the transfer has been made, recovery of the funds is almost always impossible. And I've got some of the stats around the specific types of scams where these are the most common here as well. Extortion being the first, and then tech support, government impersonation, and investment scams. And these scams also, I think it's important to note, they often go on for months and they kind of evolve over time. So something that might start as a tech support scam can evolve into a bank impersonation scam, can evolve into a law enforcement impersonation scam. And then once you've realized that you are the victim of a scam, they'll start targeting you with recovery scams. So you'll be contacted by somebody pretending that they are a lawyer who can help you get your money back if you've paid this fee. And the scamming cycle is just keep going and going. It's become really common for the same person to be re-victimized over and over and over. It's pretty awful. So again, I just want to reiterate, AARP is not anti-cryptocurrency. We're not here asking Alaska to ban cryptocurrency or prevent lawful transactions. Our goal is to really ensure that there are basic consumer protections in place that will reduce fraud and slow things down so that criminals don't have the ability to drain victims' savings. And also that law enforcement has the information they need to conduct investigations. So these are some of the legislative principles that AARP is seeking, all of which are included in the legislation that NT outlined. So I won't go into them in depth unless you would like me to talk about why any of them might be particularly helpful.
I think my question is the user identification part. What NT read was from the sectional analysis where it requires identity verification via a government-issued ID for all transactions. And since these are happening at ATMs, can you explain how your driver's license would be used at the ATM?
So the machine, you can either scan it through the camera there, or sometimes they have an app where you can take a picture and you're required to go through that KYC or know your customer process. But all of these companies have the ability to collect your government ID. And in fact, the example that you cited where the machine was asking whether you were intending to send more than $3,000, that is because there's a federal rule called the travel rule that kicks in at $3,000. So at $3,000, all financial institutions are required to collect both the sender's information and the recipient's information and then keep that. It's an anti-money laundering requirement that we have throughout our financial services, including cryptocurrency businesses. So the reason they were asking if you were trying to transact in more than $3,000 is because they wanted to know whether they had to collect your government ID or not, whether they could just let you start feeding cash into the machine before without verifying your government ID. And then one of the reasons that the government ID is so important is that without this information, it's really difficult for the companies on their end to figure out who's actually using your machine and why. One of the things that we see pretty frequently is that the scammers will reuse different phone numbers and email addresses and scams across the country. So if I go and I put in the same email address as a bunch of other fraud victims have put into these machines to the company because they're not verifying anything. It just looks to them like this is a user that uses our machines frequently because we've seen them transact before. So ensuring that the identification is being collected helps on the compliance side to make sure that they are actually double checking and that the same identifiers are not being used multiple times by different victims throughout the country. It's just another fail-safe.
Thanks, Ms. Flintbar. I'll also let committee members know that we have Tracy Reno, who's the director of the Division of Banking and Securities Department of Commerce and Community and Economic Development, online for questions, as well as Dean Fleer, Financial Examiner 3, Division of Banking and Securities for the state of Alaska. So we have a couple of folks from the state who can answer questions as well.
Oh, they really should have handled the KYC question then. Maybe they have additional comments on that.
Representative Eichheit.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, Ms. Flintbar, that was a really very interesting presentation. I have kind of a question, I guess, related to slide 3. You had some interesting data. And one of the notes I had taken during your presentation, and maybe I didn't catch it all, but I believe you had said the average defrauded amount was $40,000 per victim or event. And I was looking at your Alaska data, and of course, there's only 2 complaints in 2023, 48 in 2024, but it looks like the average defrauded amount was less than half of that, $40,000. It's $19,000. I'm just curious, hypothetically, can you explain that why it's less in Alaska? Does that mean we have less money than folks in the lower 48? But I'm not trying to make a joke out of this. This is big money. But I am curious, is there an explanation for that other than a smaller sample size here in Alaska?
I do think the smaller sample size is the answer there. So you're right, the 40,000 is a nationwide number, and that is also pulled from this same IC3 report where we were dividing the number of complaints by the amount of losses specific to cryptocurrency kiosks. I imagine, I don't know. I don't want to speculate, but I think it is just a lack of information. But I would also say $20,000 is a lot of money to have stolen from you and life-changing money for most people.
And follow up. I believe the chair had mentioned, expecting quite a larger number of complaints in 2025. I didn't catch in that dialogue, is there a date when we can expect the 2025 data, the number of complaints?
The FBI usually releases the annual IC3 report in April. I think because of the government shutdown last year, it may have been delayed till May. Typically they release their annual data in April or May. So that's when I would look for that.
Thank you.
I will ask a question of the Director of Division of Banking and Securities for the state of Alaska, Tracy Reno. I'm curious, Ms. Reno, about if you have any additional information to add about the way crypto kiosks are operating in the state. And if I were to ask a specific question, our presenter mentioned the 7 to 50% fees being charged at crypto ATMs. And I'm just curious if Alaska has any regulations on the fees at a crypto ATM or any ATM could any ATM charge 50% fees?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, this is Tracy Reno with the Division of Banking and Securities. I'm the director. I can speak a little bit about the Money Transmission Act. We regulate money transmission in the state of Alaska. Currently, there's 173 licensees. We have 6 of those licensees that are currently operating kiosks in the state. We pulled a report end of February that said we had 76 locations that we identified as kiosks throughout the state. Those are in grocery stores, gas stations, carryouts, those types of locations. So that's the information that we have related to kiosks. Depending on the company, they have their own KYC, as was mentioned, their know your customer, identifying who's opening an account. Depending on the threshold and their rules, internally policies and procedures, they may or may not require certain things to open an account. As was mentioned, depending on the threshold or the dollar amount of the transaction, there's additional requirements that are required from a customer or a person to open an account. There's also, if there's a suspicious activity, there's reports that are filed with the federal government. But the money transmission that happens in the state is regulated by the state of Alaska. We require those operating kiosks to report those locations like an agent would be. Like you walk into a Walmart or a Cars grocery store, they're an agent for a money transmitter. So we require those to be recorded as agent locations. Did that answer your question about operating in the state?
Yes. Do you have any comment on the fees charged at the kiosks?
Through the chair, Tracy Reno, Division of Banking and Securities. Regarding specific fees, we don't collect that data in reports, quarterly reports. When we go into an examination and look at the company's financials and, you know, their policy and procedures, making sure that they're compliant, we do look at the required signage that's required when a person does a transaction. There's customer facing documents that they're supposed to be able to see, and that is their fees or conversion rates. If it's going from one currency to another, maybe another country, they're required to post those, but we don't have a specific dollar amount or a percentage that's required or limited in state law.
Thank you. Any other questions from committee members? I will ask a question. It may be to Ms. Lenbar or to the sponsor, but the bill requires kiosk operators to annually provide training to staff and may not prohibit staff from educating kiosk users on fraud and scams. I'm just curious about who the staff are that would be required to take this training, since my feeling in Anchorage is that there's just all these standalone ATMs. There's no people working there.
Through the chair, Inti Mile Harbison, staff to Representative Moore. Happy to take a stab at that. I know that a lot of these machines have employees who service the machines, go to take cash out of the machines, etc. These companies do have employees, and so this training would apply to those employees, as well as some language that would prevent these companies from stopping one of those employees from trying to disseminate information related to fraud.
Thank you. My follow-up is about, I guess it's about the receipts, and I'm not seeing it. So it's in Ms. Flint Barr's saying that they need to have printed receipts. Is that in your bill?
Through the chair, it is in the bill. We are requiring receipts with a number of different items. So that would be under section 0655130, disclosures. Mm-hmm. Requires clear, conspicuous warnings about fraud at kiosks. For example, this technology can be used to defraud you, as well as mandates detailed receipts, paper and electronic, including transaction hashes, exchange rates, and law enforcement contact information.
So my follow-up on that is, in these cases of fraud where they're purchasing cryptocurrency and then putting it in someone else's wallet, sending it somewhere else, does this bill mandate that the receipt include where the money went?
I believe that falls under the transaction hash information, but I would have Ms. Clark respond to that for further clarification.
Ms. Flint Barr?
Sure. Yes, thank you. Yes, and T is right. It's the receipt information, and the reason that that's a provision that we have encouraged is that it's something that law enforcement was very insistent on. And said, if we need this information or we can't do investigations. And so the information that the receipt would have that law enforcement needs is the date, time, and the digital wallet address that and the type of cryptocurrency that the funds were sent to. And then if they have that information, rather than having to subpoena the company and wait a month it can take to get a response back, they can immediately start to investigate. One of the other provisions that was discussed in the section-by-section read-through was the use of blockchain analytics. Law enforcement also use those tools, and they can use them to trace where transactions have gone, so they can see if that money ends up at a cash-out point that is a place where they can freeze the money. So often what will happen is the victim will send the money to the criminal's wallet. The criminal will then send it sometimes like to two other intermediary wallets, and then they'll send it to Coinbase or Kraken or some other large cryptocurrency exchange in order to cash out the money, because they want the cash, or they don't want the Bitcoin. It's still fairly hard to spend cryptocurrency. And so that cash out point is a place where law enforcement can intervene, and they can send. It often doesn't work. Often the money has moved too quickly or too long ago for them to be able to do anything. But in some cases, they can have the account frozen, and they're sometimes able to get the victim's money back. And if they're not able to get the victim's money back, they are at least able to tell the cryptocurrency exchange, this is a scammer using, this is a scammer's account, and this should be flagged.
What percentage of the fraudsters are operating from another country?
I don't think there's great data on that, to be honest. But we have seen a huge trend in these transnational organized crime groups, many of them operating in Southeast Asia. Cambodia has these like massive scam camps. Actually, the president put out an executive order focused on this issue today. And what we're seeing is Chinese organized crime running these organized scam camps throughout Southeast Asia. They're also somewhat in Africa, in like Ghana and Nigeria. And they're directing these like when I say large scale, I mean like hundreds of thousands of people are employed as scammers, and they spend just all day, every day scamming people. They work through the night, they're working U.S. hours to scam people. And they've shut down a couple of these scam camps in the past few years, but it's a huge problem. And I think something that underscores that is the Department of Justice went after one of these groups that is leading these sorts of scams, the Prince Group, and they were able to seize $15 million last October, and that is the largest financial seizure ever that I know of, and it was all scam proceeds. So the international, transnational nexus here is significant.
Well, I guess like my question was like having a receipt that shows that your money went to a Cambodian camp, it may not be that helpful for law enforcement or for getting your money back.
In some cases, so the people who are working in the camp, you're right. I understand your question now. I apologize. But those people are still using the same sort of large international exchanges like Coinbase, like Kraken. So law enforcement is still often able to send legal process to them and ask them to freeze. And if it is an international exchange, in some cases the other country is not going to cooperate with the U.S. and there's nothing that you can do. But in other cases, there are relationships built through the Department of Treasury where they're able to work with their counterpart in the other country to send legal process. And so like their counterpart in Cambodia, for example, would send the legal process to the exchange there.
Thank you. I guess I'll ask one more question to either Mr. Fleer or Ms. Reno. If you could just speak to whether you guys are tracking increased fraud via crypto kiosks in Alaska or not?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, this is Tracy Reno with the Division of Banking and Securities. We are seeing an increase in complaints being filed with related to
cryptocurrency in general and kiosks. I don't have those numbers available, but we are seeing increased complaints. I can, you know, duplicate that it is difficult once the money it's sent to a wallet and then it moves quickly other places. And then sometimes it sits there in a wallet that maybe we're watching to see if where it goes. We can report it to a company and ask them to freeze the account, investigate the account. It is rare that, those funds are returned to the person who was harmed. It is very difficult. And I would just say that if a person is scammed, you know, they're in a panic. They don't listen. They don't read. They're not seeing the warnings. It's difficult for them to comprehend anything other than the panic that they're feeling when they're sending, you know, the money in these machines. And so I would suggest talking to law enforcement, local law enforcement, and perhaps, you know, the people that are on the street, the people in the stores that are watching these people walk in and put this money in the machines to see their experiences with these types of scams and what's happening in Alaska.
Thank you. Any other questions from committee? Representative Eichheit?
Thank you, Chair Gray. I think this is a question for Ms. Reno. I think it refers to a question you asked her, and I'm not sure if I heard the answer, but it was the question related to transaction fees of these crypto kiosks. And the one thing I didn't hear is there a ceiling on fees charged to folks that use a bank ATM? You know, what was that? What is that ceiling or maximum fee that regulated bank ATMs can charge in Alaska for a ATM withdrawal?
To the chair, Representative Eichheit, this is Tracy Reno at the Division of Banking and Securities. Regarding money transmission transactions or kiosk transactions, there's no ceiling in the money transmission law related to those types of things, but there is signage that's required so that when somebody is doing a transaction, they understand what that cost is going to be for the conversion of that money from one currency to another or the fee that's going to be charged by the money transmitter. Related to bank ATM fees, I don't have that information, but I can reach out and do some research and get that back to you.
Thank you.
I have one final question, and this is, I guess, maybe to Ms. Flintbar, maybe to Ms. Reno, maybe to the sponsor. If you have a digital wallet and you just have the code, are you able to go to a cryptocurrency kiosk and take money out of that wallet without showing an ID or providing a name or any identifying information?
You're asking.
Oh, sorry. I should call on one person. We'll have Flintbar go first, and Ms. Flintbar go first, and then Ms. Reno.
Sorry, my apologies. So there's two like ways that these machines function. I've focused entirely on the like cash to cryptocurrency. But are you asking if you already have a digital wallet, if you could go to one of these machines and take money out without providing an ID?
Correct.
So what we've heard from industry is that depending on the kiosk operator, about 10 to 20% of these machines do have the capability of allowing you to sell your cryptocurrency to them to take cash out. I've never found a machine where that function was working. So I've never seen it work in practice. But in theory, you can do that. And I think typically the same identification requirements would apply in that direction as well. I will say we don't really see people get scammed that way through these machines, but you can kind of think about how it could happen.
Just to be clear, I'm not talking about fraud anymore. I'm talking about drug dealers wanting to be able to get money from one place to another very, very quickly without giving their ID. I mean, I think something that we've learned a lot, like who's depositing thousands and thousands of dollars of cash daily? To me, that's somebody who's engaging in some sort of illegal enterprise where they can't use a bank. And so I'm wondering if there's ways of retrieving that cash without giving your name or ID.
Yes, but it would still be subject to those, like, for example, that $3,000 travel rule threshold. At that point, you'd have to give your ID. But yes, in theory, you could kiosk hop and clean money that way.
Ms. Reno, do you have anything to add on that?
I do not.
Thank you. Do you have any final comments, Mr. Harbison?
I don't. I appreciate the conversation that we've had in the committee today, and I look forward to presenting again before you.
Thank you so much. We will now set House Bill 324 aside and bring it back up for public testimony next Friday, March 13th, 2026. Thank you to all of our testifiers today, both online and in person. And that concludes today's business before the committee. Before we adjourn, here is a quick preview of next week's hearings. On Monday, March 9th, we will have a presentation on civil protective orders, survivor safety, and potential improvements to the system. On Wednesday, March 11th, we will hear a committee resolution on voter privacy pending introduction. We'll hear HB 211, insurance prepaid legal plans for public testimony. HB 222, workplace violence protective orders. And HJR 31, Constitutional Amendment, Corporations and Rights. On Friday, March 13th, we will hear House Bill 316, Adjust Damages, Limit Personal Injury, Wrongful Death. We will again hear this bill, House Bill 324, Virtual Currency Kiosks, and we'll be having public testimony at that time. And we will again, and then we will hear HJR 23, Constitutional Amendment, Governor's Proposed Budget, by Representative Underwood. The time is now 2:34 p.m., and this hearing of the House Judiciary Committee is adjourned.